building a path for the peace paradigm. King and Gandhi, many more, have discovered something core. Now we're building a path for the peace paradigm. Every challenge is another highway sign on the path of the peace paradigm. Ooh, 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 ooh.
Welcome, everybody, to Peace Paradigm Radio. I'm your host, Stephanie Van Hook. I'm the executive director of the Meta Center for Nonviolence. And today is Friday, August 2nd, 2015, and we are broadcasting out of KWMR in Point Reyes Station. Today's going to be a very interesting conversation. Perhaps you're listening to this show with a friend. Maybe there's somebody in your car. Maybe there's somebody that you're thinking about. And we want to talk about the power of working together. How do we transition from relationships of hierarchy, where we're trapped in isolation, really, to working together as teams? And how do we grow a movement that's horizontal? Where do we start from that? And so today on the show, we have our friend Kate Hedlund from Petaluma, who's a mother and a permaculturist and a Buddhist educator, and I think in a lot of ways. And she's been coming to the Meta Center for a Hope Tanks. And so we're very happy to have her here to help us have the conversation move forward. And our guest today is Dennis Rivers, who is working on on many websites, but one of them in particular is called newconversations.net. And this is about how do we, taking the principles of nonviolent communication to a whole nother level based on the eco-philosophy, eco-psychology. So welcome to Peace Paradigm Radio, Dennis and Kate.
Oh, I'm happy to be here today. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, and welcome, Kate, to Peace Paradigm Radio. Let's check you out.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Stephanie.
Great. So, Dennis, why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are and a little bit about the education that's brought you to this desire to talk about teams of two, which the show will be focused on today.
Well, I've been an anti-nuclear activist for about 30 years. In 1978, I was arrested for the felonious planting of wildflowers on a nuclear reactor site. And that was kind of my introduction to I was late to come to the nuclear issue. I actually got involved with the nuclear issue when a nuclear power plant was built on an earthquake fault about 30 miles upwind from where I was, which meant that if there was an accident at that nuclear power plant, that everybody where I was living in Santa Barbara would be irradiated. That was the appropriately named Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant, which mm-hmm. was built on several earthquake faults. And the original version was actually built backwards because someone put the blueprints through the blueprint machine the wrong way. And so all the earthquake bracing later had to be re-engineered because it was completely wrong. So that was an introduction, a very personal introduction to our fragile life, you know, that technology is supposed to make us, our lives more secure and but the new technology, nuclear power, is actually making our lives less secure because it's such a fragile technology and kind of depends on everybody involved being perfect, all the human beings. They never get drunk. They never cheat on their exams. They never forget to flip a switch. And we shouldn't have technologies that depend on people being perfect.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that's a bad gamble.
Mm-hmm. Was that that film Dr. Strangelove that sort of gives people that idea as well, that everything basically went according to plan, including human error went wrong in that film? The Peter Sellers film. Do you know this one?
So that motivated me to get involved with anti-nuclear activist groups in Santa Barbara, and I eventually became a nonviolence trainer and did a lot of nonviolence trainings for protesters who were on their way to Diablo Canyon to protest, and then protesters who were protesting in the early 80s against the U.S. Covert war against Nicaragua. And as I did those nonviolence trainings, an interesting thing happened. It was people kept on wanting them to be shorter and shorter. First, it was a nonviolence training weekend, and then it was a nonviolence training for one day. Then people wanted it in one afternoon. And finally, people wanted a nonviolence training that would be just 1 hour. I thought, wow, I should just show up and show them the Gandhi movie and go home.
Mm-hmm.
So there was something about training people with special knowledge for an emergency that they would only use once that seemed to be the wrong model, because people really didn't want to spend time learning special stuff that they were only going to use once. Or there was a very well-intentioned movement called the Pledge of Resistance in the early 80s, where if the United States invaded Nicaragua, then everybody who had been trained for nonviolence would show up and protest. So there you have something, well, if I ever need to, then I'll use this knowledge. Mm-hmm. So I was looking for a different model, and I went back to school and...
Wait.
Okay.
So you're looking for a different model. Why are you looking for a different model? Can you talk a little bit more about what isn't working in that model that you... Because you have the Pledge of Resistance. I mean, that's pretty inspiring that people
It was inspiring, and it had good intentions.
Okay.
If you learn skills on the basis that you're going to use them sometime in the future, you won't be... You'll forget them. And especially if you have, you're trying to learn how to remain calm in the face of threats and mobilize creative compassion in a confusing or chaotic situation. If you just do that for one weekend and then you don't do it on any kind of regular basis, you just simply won't be able to remember the skills that you learned.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out we have a lot of peacemaking to do in everyday life. So I kind of shifted gears and asked myself the question, well, how many of these challenges occur in everyday life? And how could we imagine, instead of imagining nonviolence as something that you do once every 5 years when there's a political crisis, if we said, well, how would we imagine this as something that you do every day with the people around you? And then when you practice these skills a lot, then in an emergency, you'd be able to remember them. Because, boy, when an emergency comes up, people retreat to inside of their brain to things that they've practiced for a long time. And all the theory goes out the window. So that was when I wrote the Seven Challenges workbook. Was part of my MA, and the Seven Challenges workbook is a kind of beginner-friendly guide to compassionate communication in everyday life with the people around you, helping you get more done and have more fun in the work of everyday life.
Yeah, you know, that seems to be, backing up a little bit, one of the common misconceptions about nonviolence that you're addressing right here is that you use nonviolence in specific situations that have nothing to do with our daily interactions or even the way that we interact with our own self. And that somehow without that we can just scale up all of a sudden to massive cooperative activity as though it were spontaneous without having had the adequate daily practice and discipline that nonviolence brings. And so it makes me think of, you know, Gandhi, you know, taking people in ashrams and saying that this ashram, its whole purpose is to exist, not so that we achieve enlightenment alone, but that we also learn to develop our inner capacity that we can then engage in nonviolent struggle, such as the Salt March. And so I think I really appreciate that you're bringing this out, because I think that that misconception has not yet cleared up today either. So you're doing now you've brought things out into new conversations. What do you mean by that? And what's the importance of communication? Because I think that there's a huge difference between and I'm challenging you with this, and please. But there's a huge difference between saying the right thing to somebody and being willing to risk your life in a real, you know, nonviolent confrontation. I think that you know, many kind of hardcore activists would take issue with this idea that communication alone in our personal relationships is training enough for the kind of courage that it takes to stand in front of a military officer or policeman in Oakland. Can you bring that out? I hope that I'm challenging you in a friendly way, and that you understand that I'm doing devil's advocate a little bit here.
Stephanie, you have my permission to challenge me even in an unfriendly way.
Okay.
And that would give me a chance to practice my compassion. Because not all the people who come to us are going to be friendly in the way they challenge us. Well, I think, first of all, we need to make a distinction between nonviolence as a tactic in political struggle and nonviolence as a way of life. And there, because Americans are very pragmatic and we're looking for a list of things to do that will help us get better results. So
8 highly effective habits of nonviolent activists, for example, or
yeah, something like that.
Successful activists. Yeah.
But we're not given to, as a culture, we're not given much to philosophizing or in entertaining moral or psychological theories. But as nonviolence developed in India with Gandhi, it was very much part of a way of life, and it was rooted in the spiritual ideals of India, the idea of holding on to the truth. Well, in the theology of Hinduism, truth is part of the being of God. So when you, in America, if you commit yourself to telling the truth and embodying the truth, you're committing yourself to being a nice person, a really good person. In India, when you commit yourself to the truth, to something they would call sat, you're committing yourself to kind of traveling with God, to opening your heart, to being true to the divine that is within you. So nonviolence in India has some spiritual resonances that it kind of loses in translation when it comes over here. So why should people even worry about being nonviolent? Well, the answers occur at a kind of level one or two levels up from the question. First, we have to start thinking about cause and effect, and the effects that we set in motion when we do things. I mean, Jesus talked about that when he said, I'm going to do a little edit here, whatsoever a person soweth, that also will they reap. When you think about that, Jesus, there are places, now I'm talking about a tradition that Westerners would be familiar with. There are places where Jesus asks us to be good people. He says, love one another as I have loved you. But there are other places where Jesus asks us to be grown-ups, to be very aware grown-ups, because he's saying, look at the train of cause and effect that you are setting in motion by the actions that you are taking. Mm-hmm. So that is very much in line with Gandhi's, with India's understanding of karma, and it's underneath nonviolence. Mm-hmm. One reason for refraining from violence is that the violence that you set in motion will come back to you in many ways.
Mm-hmm. So this is Dennis Rivers, and he's talking to us a little bit about some of the reasons why we should see nonviolence as a practice in our daily life that would prepare us for more strategic actions at a larger scale. And Dennis, you're on.
Well, so in trying to translate nonviolence from the Indian words, the words that the people in India use, like ahimsa, mm-hmm. not injuring, or satyagraha, holding on to the truth, I've come up with the four C's. When you look at Gandhi and Martin Luther King, what you see is four qualities of character that emerge. The four C's of nonviolence are, for me, courage. Both Gandhi and King were tremendously courageous. They were creative. You know, the Salt March, the marches and boycotts, they weren't just following a rote pattern. They weren't on autopilot. They were innovating and coming up and being creative and coming up with a unique response. So there's courage, creativity. They were deeply committed to what they were doing. They were going to hang in there. They weren't going to drop it and go home and do something else. And they were profoundly compassionate. They were concerned about the well-being of everybody.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's a famous video of African-American pastor C.T. Vivian, who was there registering voters. I think it was in Selma, Alabama. And he walks up to the courthouse door, which is guarded by Bull Connor with police dogs. And C.T. Vivian looks up to Bull Connor and shouts, "You're better than this." That's compassion for everyone in the situation. At which point, Bull Connor punched him across the face. But it was like there was nothing in Bull Connor that could stop C.T. Vivian's compassion for everyone.
Mm-hmm. And that term that people might run into in Gandhi's writings in particular is the idea of sarvodaya, the uplift of everybody. And this is something that he got out of Ruskin's writings in particular, and to this last.
Mm-hmm.
It's called when we're thinking about how our actions, are we thinking about how it affects the majority? Are we thinking about how it affects ourselves, or are we thinking that there is actually the potential for a solution for everybody? And that's where I see this kind of being threaded into a way of life, because that kind of questioning doesn't come easily. If you even believe that there's possibly a solution for everybody, then that means that you've been doing your work in nonviolence, because it takes some time, I think, to get to that place of thinking that getting beyond the conditioning of the greatest good for the greatest number, or you know, majority rules, or you know, or only just working on my small group that I can reach.
Well, you can see how each of those four qualities, compassion, creativity, courage, and commitment, mm-hmm. those are qualities that connect us with other people.
Mm-hmm.
So they're both inside of us as virtues, and they're outside of us in our and how we relate to other people. So you grow them inside of yourselves by applying them again and again to the person who's nearest to you. So that was the idea behind the Seven Challenges workbook and the new conversations, compassionate communication in everyday life, was that in everyday life we get challenged to be courageous. In everyday life we get challenged to be creative. In everyday life we get challenged to be compassionate and to be committed, you know, to hang in there and work through something. So I'm using a kind of spiral shell model here where you can start as small as you want and just start working out like the chamber nautilus. Just start reaching out to layer after layer.
And that really resonates with me that for those of us who maybe don't feel like we have the courage of a Gandhi or a Martin Luther King, that we can start in the everyday relationships that we have. And it connects very deeply to what you wrote about in your teams of two, that we could start with simply a friendship and start working on some of the skills that we could then spiral into the world and extend. And I would love to hear more about your work with the teams of two.
So continuing on in the evolution of this project, I realized looking back on my anti-nuclear activism that in the most successful groups in anti-nuclear demonstrations were often groups that had been together for years, Quakers or Mennonites or Catholic sisters. When anti-nuclear activism became part of a larger cultural movement, there was an idea of affinity groups that you would gather together with a circle of committed people and you would commit to support one another. But the affinity group movement kind of ebbed away. It didn't stay very long because I don't think there's a lot of support for affinity groups in the culture at large. There has to be a really, really strong crisis to get people out of their kind of individual consumer shell to go into a room and be with other people. For example, if your life is becoming totally unmanageable because you're drinking too much and you get really desperate, then you'll go to an AA meeting. Well, in this case, industrial civilization is like coming unglued under our feet. So more and more people are feeling that sense of desperation. Teams of Two is a model of organizing where you just find one other person. You find the issue that moves you most. And that I'm drawing from Teresa of Avila and St. Augustine. Teresa of Avila said, work on the cause that stirs in you the greatest love. So rather than saying, well, we all have to work on anti-nuclear issues. No. We all have to work on drone issues. No, we have to work on leaking nuclear power plants. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think there's actually an answer to that. So I like St. Teresa's answer, which is work on the issue that stirs in you the greatest love. When you find that issue, then find another person who's interested in that issue or find a friend who might be sympathetic to that issue and become a team of two to support one another. A team of two is an ancient organizing pattern. It has roots in ancient Buddhism around the time of Hillel and Jesus. So that's both in the history of Christianity and the history of Judaism. Teams of two emerge as an organizing pattern. For example, in the early centuries, Judaism invented something called Havruta, which is a pattern of Torah study in which the rabbi assigns you to a study partner, and the two of you are committed to study together, to question one another's understanding, and to deepen one another's understanding. And then the original Christian evangelists got sent off two by two. So I think that two by two is not a new idea, mm-hmm. and it's not my idea, but it's new in climate change organizing, and it's new in anti-nuclear organizing. I think a team of two is more resilient than an isolated individual, and it, because people can get discouraged, and when they get discouraged, you just want to crawl under your bed or quit or something. And if there's somebody to encourage you or somebody to hear your pain and frustration, then you might be able to stay involved a lot longer.
Mm-hmm. So Dennis Rivers of newconversations.net is here in the studio talking to us about teams of two and how this kind of ancient organizing by coming together in teams of two in pairs can help us to encourage one another to take on huge issues that otherwise alone we can't do, and working in very large groups becomes almost impossible as well. Can you talk a little bit more about why a team of two versus working in a team of 200?
Well, I will. All of the team of two material is available at earthcitizens.net. So you can find the articles. I also want to say about the teams of two idea and the teams of two articles that are on earthcitizens.net mm-hmm. is that it's all in the Creative Commons. Mm-hmm. So I've placed all this material in the Creative Commons so that any group can use it and any group can modify it to meet their needs. So I'm quite explicit. This is not an idea that I own or that I've copyrighted, but just the opposite. It's an idea that everyone owns and that everyone can use. So
why two instead of 200, though? Because in nonviolence, there's a lot of discussion about if you get enough people in a room, then you've been effective. So why now you're saying reduce that number so drastically to just two people? How is that?
Well,
there's
two things come up for me when you ask that question. One is that in many groups of 200, I can feel completely lost. Mm-hmm. And although I'm connected to everybody, I'm not connected to any one buddy. Mm-hmm. And so I've experienced that a lot, of being lost in the crowd. Also, there's the question of continuity of engagement. How are you going to arrange continuity of engagement with 200 people? I'd be thrilled to have 200 people in a room who are concerned about what's the next step in relation to leaking nuclear power plants. But how to arrange that with 200 people would be a monumental task. So you could say that a team of two is the smallest imaginable affinity group.
You're listening to Peace Paradigm Radio, and I am Stephanie Van Hook. I'm here in the studio with Dennis Rivers of newconversations.net and Kate Hedlund from Petaluma, California, who is a volunteer with the Meta Center. So we were talking about with Dennis about the power of teams of two. So how do we organize really big resistance to really big challenges is the question. And the model so far has been getting a lot of people together to try to somehow strategically organize to bring down a dictator or to, you know, doing even the work of Gandhi, saying constructive program, building the kind of world that we'd rather live in. That takes a lot of people to be involved in that. And now, on the other hand, at the Meta Center, we've always talked about person power, the power of the individual person, because our power is not coming from our ability to take down a dictator. That's the expression of a power, but our power doesn't come from that. It comes from within, and each one of us has this within ourselves is the way that we go with this idea of person power versus people power, where people power is this idea of you get enough people in, and all of a sudden you'll be powerful because you'll be able to coerce somebody else into doing something that they don't want to do because they're isolated and that you have the majority of people. And so this kind of underlying thread that ties them both together is the concept of Sarvodaya, or the uplift of everybody, the well-being well-being of everybody can be involved. How do we organize along principles that help us to work toward the uplift and betterment of everybody? And Dennis Rivers is making a radical suggestion that isn't actually that radical, and it's a new suggestion that isn't that new, to talk about, well, what if you did something that you totally can do, which is to find just one other person to work with on a given issue. And he's calling this his teams of two. And you can find the article at earthcitizens.net, Dennis.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So, okay, this is an ancient new idea. Yesterday was the anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima, for example. And
yes,
this is a very serious day and should be an opportunity for us to think where the world stands at this time on nuclear weapons and building weapons of mass destruction or even weapons of individual destruction. We need to think about the worldview that we've espoused that's gotten us to this kind of logical end of the atom bomb. You know, of the more violence that we have in our small relationships, the more that we'll turn to that violence in really big issues, and the more that we find ourselves willing to dehumanize large groups of people. So talk a little bit, I think this is really interesting. How would a team of two work to address this issue that's been so dear to your heart, the nuclear issue and weapons of mass destruction?
Well, I started the teams of two idea precisely because the nuclear issue is more than one heart. It's more pain than one heart can carry. So we're facing issues that are, we might call them emotionally corrosive, that if there's a particular, for example, if there's a particularly dangerous intersection in a city and a lot of people are getting hurt at that intersection, I could get angry and sad and frustrated in a way that would be within my capacity to tolerate as a person. And I'd round up some friends and I'd say, we're going to go and we're going to occupy City Hall until the city council changes, puts a boulevard stop at that or a traffic signal at that dangerous intersection. That dangerous intersection doesn't challenge my sense of being safe on the surface of planet Earth. So it's a local problem kind of within my grasp. But when we're talking about climate warming, catastrophic climate change, and leaking nuclear waste plants, leaking nuclear power plants or leaking nuclear waste dumps, of which we have plenty of both, we're now starting to deal with issues that are, you might say, they're unnerving. They eat away at our sense of wanting to get out of bed in the morning. So I'm now advocating that nobody work on nuclear issues without a kind of, we might call it a swim buddy. You know, it's like if you're going to swim in that deep water, you've got to get somebody to find someone to go with you, just like summer camp. I'm applying the summer camp swim buddy model to when we're working on issues that are really difficult to assimilate. I don't think that our mind-body, I don't think our nervous system, we're not made to contemplate the end of the world. That's why people go so crazy when they do it. And we are facing end-of-the-world style threats from several different directions, of which the most prominent are catastrophic climate change. Then there's nuclear stuff. And there's a lot of chemical poisoning and genetic engineering that's going on that could, well, for example, feeding antibiotics to farm animals could produce catastrophic epidemics with drug-resistant viruses or bacteria for which we would have no remedy. So industrial civilization is turning into a kind of a Frankenstein. And in the face of that, I want people to have someone to talk to or a hand to hold. Or one of the principles I've been trying to work at this level of deep principles, and a couple of the principles that I've come up with is the deeper the task you put into a person's hands, the deeper the support you ought to offer them. Mm. Now, that makes sense to me. Now, I want you to work on the issue of planet Earth becoming uninhabitable by human beings. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty deep issue to put in your hands. Mm-hmm. However ready or unready you are, here it is, Stephanie. And I think that if I do that, I ought to say, and I will walk along beside you.
Right. The reason that I am having you on the show today, Dennis Rivers of New Conversations, .net, is because this idea of teams of two, I think, is very, very inspiring. How you can... You're saying, okay, here's these really big issues, and we've had to kind of scale it down. We've gone through this discussion about how, you know, nonviolence doesn't happen just on these like large and these large social movements. It's happening as a way of life. It's happening every day. So we've scaled it down a bit, right? But then there seems to be this need then to be able to now step up what we've learned in our day-to-day relationships, or, you know, in, if I'm doing nonviolence in the classroom with children that I work with, you know, of course, you know, these principles make a lot of sense. But somehow there seems to be this stuckness in either working on these really big issues with a lot of people or staying isolated on, well, this is just a daily practice. I'm just going to focus on what's in front of me. So I really like this idea that, okay, so helping another person to work on a really big issue with you, or just providing the kind of encouragement that we all need to keep these big ideas flowing through us is really, really cool. And so what does that look like in practice, Dennis? Are you a part of teams of two? And what do you do? Do you have a weekly phone call? Do other people join you? What do you talk about? How long?
I'm involved in about 15 two partnerships.
Okay.
And my most recent was I have teamed up with a human rights activist, Elliot Adams, who lives in New York.
He's been on this show before.
Hmm. Yeah. And Elliot and I are editing a page on human rights, the Geneva Conventions, the Nuremberg Principles. So we have a shared project, which is almost like a little magazine that we're editing together. And some of my team of two partners, my team, you're not limited in your life to one team of two partnership. So several of my team of two partners now have a new understanding of that they could start team of two partnerships for the really challenging and demanding issues, other issues that they're involved in their lives. Mm-hmm. So just now I was thinking, Kate, how would team of two work for permaculture? Permaculture is a movement of a more sustainable relationship to the world around you. I'm wondering, could you imagine, would you tell us a little about permaculture, which I think is one of the most creative movements on the planet today, and how, which usually unfolds around workshops. How would team of two play out in the permaculture movement?
Well, I think there are two considerations. One is a permaculture principle that advocates that we start small and we grow by chunking, so that if you start in a very small way and you get larger slowly, you have less chance of kind of catastrophic failure. So if you, instead of trying a group of 2,000 people and trying some kind of social experiment, if you try it in a team of two, the the downside of any type of failure is pretty small in a group of two, and you can learn a lot in that small area and start applying it and growing on your successes. And so I think that kind of ties into a lot of educational theory as well, of the idea of scaffolding, where you take something small and you build on it little by little and grow in those. As you succeed, you can grow in that. And rather than trying to take something enormous and maybe not having the skills to apply that into your life immediately. So it builds you up for greater success.
Mm-hmm. So I mentioned that there were two big ideas that I was developing, but I only said the first one, that the greater the task you put into another person's hands, the deeper the support you ought to offer them. The other is that the deeper the ugliness we intend to confront and mend in the world, the deeper the beauty we need to carry in our own hearts. This came to me after working on the torture issue for about 5 years, because the torture issue is really ugly. People do ugly things to each other, and they say ugly things to each other, defending the ugly things that they do to somebody. And I found myself getting I was depressed by the ugliness of it, and I gradually became aware that if I'm going to wade into this ugliness, how am I letting beauty into my life? Is there a place in my life for that? How would I find it? It's such a personal, intimate kind of question. But on one of my websites called Companions and Blessing, I have something I call the Interfaith Cathedral. And in the Interfaith Cathedral, I invited all my friends to tell me the most beautiful piece of music they had ever heard, or the most beautiful piece of artwork they had ever seen. And I put them all in one place as a kind of celebration for us to go there and remember what we're called to bring forth in the world.
Something that really intrigues me that you bring up, Dennis, is this this idea that a friend could be a great source of support. And in our society, you talk a little bit about this in some of your work, that we have this drive toward professionalization, where only psychologists maybe would be seen as fit for being support for really deep psychological issues or feelings of inadequacy or depression that are coming up as you were looking at torture or nuclear waste. But what you're saying is that we also need a place in our lives where we have friendships and networks of support that go beyond the professional realm of maybe working with a psychologist.
Well, that's true. And in my work, I'm drawing on the work of several psychologists, especially Carl Rogers is one. Lawrence Brammer is another. He's less well known. But they are talking about the power of human beings to support one another. And especially Carl Rogers is the pioneer of this, that we have, just as ordinary people, we have three deep gifts to give to each other. One is what Rogers called unconditional positive regard, that we can care about each other. The second is that we can be honest with ourselves and with the other person. Instead of playing games or wearing masks, we can be as real as we possibly can. And then the third gift that we can give each other is actively voiced empathizing. As I listen to you going through your struggles, I try to sum up and say out loud very briefly what I hear you going through, kind of from your perspective, not from my perspective like I'm going to try and fix it or analyze it, but just say, wow, something like, I hear you're really having a difficult time with that. That actively voiced empathy is, it's magic. And Rogers was a professor of psychology, and in the years after World War II, tape recorders became available, and Rogers was the first person to tape record psychotherapy sessions. And then he analyzed hundreds of psychotherapy sessions, and he had the aha moment that what made psychotherapy work was the presence of these three qualities in the helper, that of unconditional positive regard, actively voiced empathy, and kind of honesty, sincerity in interaction. So those are gifts that we can all give each other. And in the face of the great crises of the world, we are empowered, in Roger's vision, we are all empowered to be deeply supportive of one another. And that's not something that only licensed psychotherapists can do.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned this this article, this interest, the companions and blessing. And I have an article that we read before the show today mm-hmm. that we will be making available with the archive of the show at MediCenter.org called Companions in the Storm, Companions in Blessing, Reflections on the Role of Friendship in the Mending of a Broken World. And as we're thinking with you, Dennis Rivers, about the power of teams of two and having many teams of two in our life to help us address the big social issues that we are, it's our duty to address for a more healthy world for the next generations beyond us, friendship plays such a big role. And you, in this article, go over many kinds of friendship, that not all friendship is necessarily the same thing, that you take a very pragmatic approach to interrelation, to interbeing. And I was wondering if you might, in some of the time that we have left, talk about these different kinds of friendships that you have been so inspired by. And maybe because I think that it'll help us to see that, not one friend can or should necessarily be all of these things for us either, which is a lot of pressure. Not only are you going to be my partner in life, you're going to be my team of two for the nuclear shoe, and which is starts to pile on to a person, and whatever else we do together. Can you talk about these different kinds of friendships, and so we can start to see them in our own lives as well?
Well, I'm very interested in the way you could say the in-breath and out-breath of life. I use the in-breath, out-breath as a model for a lot of processes in life. And that also has an ancient history. It has a history in both Hinduism, in ancient Hinduism, and a history in the early Middle Ages. There was a Jewish philosopher, a Kabbalistic philosopher who lived in the Mediterranean, his name's flown out of my head right this second, who developed a whole philosophy of life based on and of the cosmos based on in-breath and out-breath. So when we take a quality that we would like to embody, like compassion or truthfulness, it turns out that that's an inner quality, but it's also a quality of our interactions with other people. So most of the qualities, the character qualities that we would like to embody turn out to be also, they unfold in our interactions with other persons. So it's almost like although we tend to think of developing our strengths. If I go to the gym and I lift weights, I get muscles, and there doesn't have to be anybody else involved. But that's not necessarily a good model for becoming a person, because when I'm trying to develop kindness and courage and awareness, all of those unfold with me in dialogue with you. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like I can't be a me without a you. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that sets the stage for various kinds of being a companion in blessing, being a companion in conscience.
So what is a companion in blessing?
Well, that's where we realize that we're not alone. I guess this is, it's so deep. Sometimes it's hard to talk about it. But we have the original form of thinking is conversation. We learn how to think because we internalize the conversations that we have with our primary caregivers, mostly our mom. So we take those conversations inside of us and they gradually become thinking. But at the and so we think by ourselves, but when we think by ourselves, we're using patterns that we learned in the company of another person. So quite often when we want to think about the deepest issues, we go and we want to talk to somebody. Mm-hmm. You know, when a person's troubled by a complex conflict, they want to go to confession, or they want to go talk to a psychotherapist, or they want to let their hair down with a friend. So a companion in blessing is someone who, you know, I feel the pain of a world unraveling, and I want to do something to mend the world. That's a deep human calling. And when I recognize that impulse and motivation in you, and you recognize it in me, we become companions in blessing because we're no longer isolated in that intention to mend the world. We realize, well, we're not crazy, that we're actually doing something that's deeply human. I think one of the temptations in life when you face a crisis, a giant moral crisis, is basically to say, well, I'm just too neurotic, or I'm just crazy, and the world's really okay, I'm just nuts. So mm-hmm. therefore, I don't have, you can crazify yourself, mm-hmm. and that's a way of resolving the tension because I no longer have a big threatening world to confront because I'm just neurotic.
You just internalize that.
Yes. When in the company of another person, I can say, this is a beautiful message from Joanna Macy. In the company of another person, I can realize with some encouragement of another person that my pain for the world is not a mistake. It's not something that I should try to drink or drug or therapize out of existence. My pain for the world is actually an expression of my love for the world.
Beautiful. Dennis Rivers with newconversations.net talking to us about being companions in blessing and then taking on that blessing of moving forward with teams of two. Very simple idea, teams of two to address some of the biggest issues that will help us to be companions in nurturing and protecting all of life.
Resilient companions in blessing.
Beautiful. Resilient companions in blessing. Where can people find out about your work? Newconversations.net.
Newconversations.net has my communication skills workbook, the Seven Challenges workbook, and then
EarthCitizens.net. EarthCitizens.net. Mm-hmm.
Has the Team of Two article and the Companions in Blessing article.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Dennis Rivers, for joining us here on Peace Paradigm Radio today. And thank you so much, Kate Hedlund, for joining us too and as part of MediCenter. And to all of our friends out there listening, we hope that you have a wonderful time finding your team of two and that you do your very best in every possible way to take care of one another. Until the next time. Bye-bye.